Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the poet Mike Pewikin. Mike Pewikin has published widely, including the journals Luna, Crab Orchard Review, Another Chicago Magazine, The Bloomsbury Review, and Spoon River Review. He regularly writes reviews of poetry for Another Chicago Magazine. He has read his work in numerous Chicago poetry venues and on Chicago Public Radio. Hi, Mike. Welcome to Prosody.
Hi. Nice to be here.
Well, glad to have you. Could you start off with some poems tonight?
Yeah, sure.
Great.
I'm going to start off with a poem that I wrote in from a trip to Santiago, Chile. This was a couple of years ago. I stayed in a working-class neighborhood called Peñalolén, and I was struck by talking with a lot of the people who had been around when Pinochet came into power and all of the brutality that happened at that time. Just how much these people had experienced. I talked with one man who said the street right outside the apartment where I was staying, he walked 2-3 miles, and he lost count of the number of bodies during that time. During that visit, I participated in a procession for Good Friday, and the entire congregation walked through Peñalolén, and they reenacted the Stations of the Cross. And I was struck because there was so much attention given to this event, the killing of Jesus, on a street where so many people had been killed 30 years ago. That confluence is what stirred this poem. It's called Good Friday. Santiago, the pigeons fly through our forgetfulness. The prayers release us from our intentions, release us from the body falling to the street, the stain of blood by the bus stand. Santiago, heart crazy with hope, unfilled as an empty coffin. Your men once stood with bound hands at the soccer stadium. They knew who they were. They knew what their future was. They could say anything. Today we say the Stations of the Cross. Pigeon, stick, fire, water, butcher, unmoving chest of the deacon's wife, children hiding under cars waiting for the soldiers to leave, corpses with ancient chambers still thudding inside their hearts, smoke rising from the students splayed across the playing field. Black smoke gathers inside our mouths. A boy is strapped to a cross and raised above the crowd. We gather around. Our prayers are said loud and open-throated. They are the same prayers of the rising ghosts. As the procession moves through the neighborhood, the white lips on corpses begin to open. Now that heaven's been destroyed, we can say anything. This piece is called Shoes. It's a gazelle, and a gazelle is a series of unrelated couplets that somehow, if it's successful, pull together to have an effect, a total feeling from the poem. A little girl takes her new red purse to bed. In the middle of the night, she calls out for her shoes. Children are playing tag in the snow. Where are their shoes? Each detail of the first lady's outfit has been attended to. Where are her shoes? Then one day you wake up, a rain of melted glass and shoes. The observables, subjects segmented by how much they spend on shoes. Men stand blindfolded against a wall. Beside them, their socks are tucked neatly into their shoes. Before entering the plane, you must remove your shoes. The corpse seems to have lost one of them. I grew up in Pennsylvania, and one thing that people everywhere east of Ohio do during the summertime is they vacation at the shore. And my family did the whole time I was growing up. We went to Atlantic City every year. One time, my family was photographed on the beach, and our picture ran in a little local newspaper in Atlantic City. This poem is about that moment. Atlantic City, 1959. The mother's gift is her language, the fullness of her words creating sidewalks one can walk across. Today, as the ruined country assembles us, the lyric moment disassembles. Our family photo, 7 of us on the same towel. We smiled while each one slowly released the hope of ever being understood. And look, in the corners of our eyes, salt scum, beach fires raging that no one would see. My mother whispered, "Children, the image is not you. It will never remember your name." As this new century unfolds, darkness has become a substitute for love. But on that day, seven lighthouses shone with a light that did not begin with the sun. The camera's flash still clings to my eyes. Her words still rest in my ears. "Children, remember, these chameleons will always be testing us." My day job, actually, until very, very recently, has been in marketing. Marketing's pretty a pretty interesting and really bizarre world. I've tried to write about it many times. Only a couple of poems have come from it. But this is one. It's called "Why I'm in Marketing." A boy helped his uncle install a bathtub. Aunt Margaret was so pleased. Now he owns a chain of plumbing supply stores. One kind word and we're ophthalmologists. How does this happen? When I was 17, I told my dad I'd never go straight. Now I wake up surrounded by positioning statements. It's our big chance to be somebody. The clerk typist who claims to predict the future. The head of auditing who hums at the urinal. The vice president with great legs. The founder started all this from nothing. He could sell anything to anybody. He taught his parakeet the whistle to the company tagline. The guy from HR says money is the third most important reason people work. So is it the health plan? The free samples of product? What she's crossing and uncrossing as I explain why sales are down? The three-story woman in her underwear was my idea. It stopped traffic, but no one bought the oatmeal. Now security wants to escort me to my office. They say I'll need some empty boxes. The task force on turnover is celebrating. They saved thousands in postage to terminated employees. The founder bursts into the meeting. "We're not selling breakfast here. We're selling escape." Everyone pretends to write it down. The bird keeps sticking its head through the bars. It can't get it back in. The clerk typist gazes into her crystal and says, "This is starting to piss me off."
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the poet Mike Puikin. You know, Mike, you had a perfect segue for me because I actually wanted to talk about marketing and poetry, of all things. And it's because in your work, you know, I don't think anybody would aspire necessarily to write a poem about marketing. I think maybe being a marketer, you're like, I want to come at it from a different angle. But I think if you gave that to a class saying, you know, it's like, write a poem about accounting, they might say, what? But there is, and especially that juxtaposed with the poem prior, there is something about, at least I think, you know, from my perspective, I see it. Marketers, in essence, pay attention to a lot of everyday stuff and try to figure out a way to make people believe it will absolutely transform their lives. It'll make them happy. It'll make them pretty. It'll make them everything they ever wanted to be. And that's why they have to have that product. And in your poetry, there's a lot of everyday stuff in it. You know, it's very, in the best sense, very Americana. But there's this dark underbelly. You know, all of those objects turn into other things. They at times become very threatening. It's like the anti-marketing ploy. And I was just, you know, I wanted you to just maybe talk a little bit about what you choose to write about.
Hmm. Well, first of all, one thought I had as you were asking me the question. Typically, I listen to half the question and think of my answer before I hear the end.
That's
of it.
That's fine.
But here's a big difference. While marketing and writing are similar in that you are trying to evoke a response, you're trying to evoke an emotional response. The big difference is marketing spends a lot of time and they're only interested in what the customer's response is. And in writing, I'm interested in my response. Of course, I want you and the audience to respond, but it comes from me. Mm-hmm. Whereas we don't trust in marketing anything that we feel. We have to know what the customer wants, what the consumer wants. It's a huge difference because if you're a marketer, you just will say anything.
And we know poets don't do that. They're very picky about their words.
Every single one of them. Anyway, what was the final part of your question?
Well, it was that, so family going on vacation and taking that photograph. And, you know, how many of us have those photographs or our parents have saved those photographs? There's, you know, even in the first poem, though it's said in the context of a historical moment of another country, there's these kind of everyday people, everyday objects that you choose. So I'm just curious, like, what draws your attention? Mm. You know, what is it you look at that makes you think, oh, I need to write a poem about that?
You know, it is all about my response. It's all about my emotional response. Even, Ellen, in what we're doing right now, you know, we're both experiencing this moment, but then it has a meaning. It has an emotional response to it. And that leap that goes from the present, from the sensual experience to the emotional response is all about what I'm all about. So it is in that. So sitting on this couch over there, I could, you know, my mind could take me somewhere.
Sure.
All right. I'm surrounded by worrying about breakfast cereal all day and how how it stays crunchy in milk. Well, you know, there's 1,000 moments in that day that leap into meaning and that leap into some odd, interesting response. And so just receiving all those impulses is where I go to start writing.
Yeah. And when I was making the comparison between marketing and poetry, I'm not reducing that. It's what's so, what I've, you know, in your work that I kept looking at over and over again is that, you know, it's almost like you take it to the next philosophical moment, yeah, which I don't think most marketers really care about. But, you know,
no,
it is like
it,
all of a sudden you start thinking about breakfast cereal in milk. Like how many regular people, you know, you're just irritated if it gets soggy. And that's about as far as it goes. And the marketer takes it one more step to say, well, you know, how do we make it so they're not irritated?
Right.
And so they'll buy more. And then as a poet, you're just like, but what does all this mean?
Yeah, right. There's a secret in marketing. And that is, you pay no attention to the product. You pay attention to what the product means. Now, it's really subtle, but there's a huge difference in it.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the poet Mike Puikin. Mike, will you read some more for us?
Sure. I have taken a number of workshops. I give workshops over the years. I was at one that asked for us to remember a defining moment in a relationship and write about that. So I remembered a time when my ex-wife and I spent the entire evening arguing about whether there was intelligent life beyond human beings. It was a defining moment. This is called Search for Intelligent Life. This morning someone said, "You're crazier than the weather." As I write this, the Jeffrey Pine smells like vanilla and pineapple. The couple laughing in the outdoor cafe sound like blue jays mating. There was a time when our connection was the scent of pineapple and mango, the exchange of hair products, the first bite at your favorite restaurant. It was sour and pickled. We argued over whether there was intelligent life beyond humans. I said, "Were you waiting for ants to climb up to your ears and speak English? With special listening devices, we've even heard the ants singing." You said, "But is it good singing? A squirrel leaps from one tree to another as though there is a life after this one. We used to make love like that, watching ourselves in the mirror, looking for the distance required to fall in love." There is a way things can come from out of nowhere, like the time we learned the name of the dance was cha-cha-cha, or when your relative stood on the picnic table and started screaming. It's how they knew they were alive, through bitterness and concentration, as later we did. Everything was fine until one of us salted the soup wrong. Then all hell broke loose. Time doesn't really fly. We just have faulty memories. Today, the sun breaks through the clouds. It makes the tips of the aspen leaves disappear. Today, the ants have a headache. They're just going through the motions as they rise through the cracks in the sidewalk, as they climb over my shoes, as they carry away my chair. Well, despite a number of difficult relationships, things have worked out for me. I'm married again, very happily, to another poet Ellen, who you know, Mary Holly. Mm-hmm. This is a poem I wrote soon after we got married. It's called In Paradise the Mind Wanders. Slip out of your pink slip. Tell me the source of these uneasy feelings. No, show me. As we planned the wedding, you forgot the parking brake and kept rolling into cars. I was about to be fired. We couldn't decide whether to argue about the caterer's bill or lick each other. There are many ways to communicate, you said, like the communication in your thin dress and a warm breeze in Texas at 4 a.m., or the crickets parting just 6 inches ahead of your arms in the dark, wet grass, showing us the world is not our own. Now we live like everyone else in the beautiful suburbs, the same breakfast cereals, the same darkness within. You told me to find the peculiarity in every moment. We will never get this exact collection of junk mail again, or feel this particular wind that touched huge flocks of canaries, lunar probes on their way out, the ancestors of dogs. We approach each meal the way we make love, with wonder. But how long do we stay grateful at this banquet? As you sleep, I listen to trucks speeding down the expressway, Randy Travis blaring from their stereos, bugs splattering onto their windshields. Never the same bug twice. My wife is a devout Catholic, and while I was raised Catholic, I'm an atheist. Still, I go to church with Mary, and I find it a very provocative experience. It's really interesting to me. One of the things that I'm struck by is how specific the prayers and petitions get, and how much interest there is in really detailing very specific instances in prayer. Mary says that she believes that God listens to the specific, and I find that a very provocative notion. This poem is called For Dolores After Her Fall, For Paolo, whose son is dying. Taken by sacrament, sprawled at the genius of incense and ceremony, you soaring voices of the three entreaties, acceptance, memory, deliverance, step up to the altar, detail the bleeding. You sacks of winged birds, canters to the tricked-out void, retrace again the steps of the murder. Name each one of the sick and anguished flying in their rag of blood and bone while there is still time and every crumb of the Eucharist is precious. You who stroke the flapping robes of every one of us falling, mouths filled with each drop of blood. O Lord, hear your prayer. This poem is called Hear. It encapsules my faith and struggle with faith. One man crosses his legs, and three people he's talking to cross their legs. Two students alternately read a book on palms and then look at their own palms. A couple rows out to the middle of the lake and throws the oars overboard. A woman stands alone at her kitchen window burning photos in the sink. A girl finishes her day singing because her life is like no other. A package truck sign says, "We're delivering more than your package." A 9-year-old with a mouthful of ice blows smoke into the summer air. A man tells his doctor, "We've gone over this so many times before." And then he breaks down. To be still, completely still, and not think of God.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the poet Mike Pewikin. Mike, I noticed also in your work, there seems to me this very delicate tension between melancholy and hope. You know, a poem starts to go and kind of the images start to, or even a line, take you in a darker direction. And then all of a sudden you find like this little moment of hope, and kind of the opposite, you know, there's this kind of nice image and you think, oh, that's a pretty hopeful image. And then all of a sudden it's got this kind of shadow underneath it. And so I'm wondering if that's a dynamic that you focus on. I guess this question I'm asking more in the crafting of the work. Is that a dynamic that, you know, of course, I think with most writers, there's the impulse, as we had talked about, the kind of emotional response. And so you start to put it down on the page, but then you have to craft it. Do you find yourself like trying to keep that balance, or, you know, have you ever had a poem that was just a little too happy and you had to make it a little sadder?
You know, it's a great question. I am striving to replicate experience. And so it's never all one or all the other. I mean, even in the darkest despair, we just can't help it. There's a glimmer that's going to draw us toward life. Writing the most depressing work that one can imagine is a hopeful act because it's writing, it's creating. There's this tension, and so when I write, I don't write toward anything. I write little bits of things and then try to connect them. And those bits of things are little elements that I look for where there's a lot of energy, a lot of juice. Where there's a lot of energy is where there's the tension, and you know, where there's, I'm filled with ecstatic feelings throughout a day and not ecstatic feelings. And so to be able to join those is where I find tension. In terms of crafting, continuing to violate expectations, continuing to go down one direction only to find that you're in a different room, is what can make a piece interesting. And so it's that impulse that keeps me, it's that energy that I continually am drawn toward.
And I think about the poem you read, about when you and Mary, after you'd gotten married, the line where what the wind touches in the last one is the ancestors of dogs. That's definitely a moment where it's like ancestors of dogs. That's not where I thought that line was going. And it is. And there's a, you know, as a reader, there's a real pleasure in that surprise, because I think, maybe it's because of the bombardment of language that we're all in these days, because of all the ways language can get at us, that it's nice to have those kind of odd juxtapositions, because it's almost like you feel you can fill in the blank, and it's nice to be taken somewhere you're not expected to go. I do want to talk a little bit more about language. You know, if you were a prose writer, I would say you're kind of in the Raymond Carver, Hemingway camp. Mm. There's a real compression of language. And beyond that, beyond the conciseness and the compression of it, there's a lot of times not talking about the direct thing, talking about maybe the thing that's right next to the direct thing, or kind of the space that's created by something. So in terms of language, you know, what are you looking for when you're working with words? Like, how do you use language?
I look for, you know, I could say this is my marketing background, but it's not. But I look for directness and immediacy. I mean, there's times when I'm reading my poems that I am sort of taken over with emotion, and of course, it's that kind of writing that I'm very drawn toward. So, not having really thought about this in great depth, I'm looking for directness. Now, what that means, and you know, we're kind of schooled in this, is you use short words. Words that are not vague, that are not real abstract. I go here and do this, and where you go and what you've done is really strong, those eight words, whatever they are, just go right through you, as opposed to something that takes two sentences.
So when you're writing, is it a process of whittling down, or does that directness happen first and you have to kind of build on it?
No, it's a whittling down. It's a crafting. I mean, you know, I'd love
to
say.
Otherwise I'd have to hate you. It's good to know from those of us who also whittle and do not have the automatic sense of the perfect word the first time through. How about you end up with a couple poems?
Sure.
Great.
Here's a poem that really encapsulates the the discussion I have with my wife about the existence of God. It's a pantoum. Usually, pantoums don't interest me at all because it's a form that requires repeating words over and over again. But it was really a great form because I could change the rules around a little bit and vary a word or two to really represent my point of view and Mary's point of view. It's called Subtle is the Lord. In the realm of the five senses, what does desire attach to? The wildness of the heart increases in the dark. The presence of no God only makes it wilder. You said we must also consider the gorilla suit we are singing in. The wildness of the heart only increases in the dark. You said, subtle is the Lord, my head is tied to a pole. We must consider the gorilla suit we are singing in. The secret is not so much unsaid as wordless. Subtle is the Lord, your head is tied to a pole. There is nowhere to go, church is on fire. The secret is not so much unsaid as wordless. You said the sound and light show begins in the dark. There is nowhere to go, church is on fire. You said for God to speak, remove your hands from his throat. The sound and light show begins in the dark. Inside you is a light that doesn't come in or go out. For God to speak, remove your hands from his throat. In the realm of the five senses, what is desire attached to? A hidden light that doesn't shine in or go out. You said, the presence of God only makes it wilder. This is As If Talking. I am late May burning through Manitoba. A clump of crocuses breaks out of my face. A bonfire blazes in the cold fog, clearing the hair in my throat. Distance is so dependent on the past. The outline of your body is all the more attractive because of where you came from, what you gave up to be here. This desire is like the burn of spring scraping across northern Canada, like the moment before climax that says, I am granting you your rights. This morning my father appeared in the melting snow of a cornfield. A splash of blood from his eye fell into my eye. I see him now, blooming from my face reflected in the spring. The distance between here and the far future is within reach. Touch me. We become the next century's street signs. A red fox crosses the mud. A crack explodes off the ice. Something puts its hands over my ears. Can you hear me now?
Thanks for coming to Prosody, Mike.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the arts entertainment news weekly published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Joseph Wilk and Lauren Wolf, with special thanks this week to Daryl Jones and Electric Mayhem Studios in Chicago. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody on Independent Public Radio, 91.3 WYEP. She had a smile that swerved, she had a smile that curved, she had a smile.